You're listening to People Powered Radio, proudly supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. cbf.com.au.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Community Connections. I'm Alan Collier, and it's my pleasure to be with you for, well, actually the next 3 hours, being the second Wednesday of the month between 12 and 1's our legal hour. I have with me Grant Hutchinson. Welcome, Grant.
G'day, Alan.
The supremo of Hutchinson Lego.
Lego. You've been watching Lego Masters, haven't you?
No, I haven't. And we've got Jack Kennedy also from Hutchinson Legal. Welcome, guys.
No, thanks for having us.
Yeah. Not a problem. Now, we sent you off with a bit of homework last time about appeals. We want to know that a person's convicted, how many times they can appeal against that conviction, and what the judge has to take into account before he makes a decision whether he's going to allow an appeal or not. Yeah. And how far can you appeal? You know, can you go as high as a high court or whatever? So over to you, Jack. I believe you've got the answers.
Yeah, sure. So which one did you want me to start with, Alan?
Anything to do with the appeals.
Anything to do with the appeals? Okay, well, we can start off with, actually, first I'll say that most of this, all of this data was sourced from the Victorian Sentencing Council. So we know that it's factual.
Yep.
And we'll just go. So of the 1,910 cases heard between 2013 and 2014, only 230 were appealed. So this represents about 12% of cases.
Yep.
Okay, so
how many of those were successful?
So how many were successful? Only 3% of all of those 1,910 cases were successful. So not many at all were successful. Yep. Offenders, so obviously the offender can appeal and the Crown can too. It's not always just the criminal in these matters.
The Crown would mainly only appeal to the leniency, wouldn't they? They wouldn't appeal against an actual conviction, would they?
They would appeal, yes.
I think it's as to the whether the sentence was adequate. I think once you get off, you get off. It's a normal rule, but yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yes, no, 100%. So, what was that? Sorry. Where were we? So of those, yeah, so when the offender appeals, they are successful about 29% of the time, which is quite interesting when you compare that
Can I just ask you, is that 29% where they get another trial, or is it 29% where they get off altogether?
No, not altogether. So when they appeal, 29% of their appeals are successful. What's interesting to note is that when the Crown appeals, 70% of their appeals are successful. And so, obviously, that shows a significant difference between offenders and the Crown. And it begs the question, is the Crown more successful because they're more prepared? Or maybe it's got something to do with offenders being more inclined to appeal because they're personally invested in the case. So, that's something interested. What do you think about that, Grant?
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I've seen... So, certainly... when you're wanting the appeal because it's your own self-interest, whereby the Crown is often looking at what is this relative to other cases that they've seen. Yep. So it's kind of a benchmark that you would expect for certain things.
Also, could it be that the offender, if he or she gets a custodial sentence, that they've got a lot more time to prepare a case? Like, they don't move on with their lives, they're in this spot? Could that be part of it?
Well, definitely. Actually, of all the appeals made in Victoria, 96% of them were based on penalties of imprisonment. So it does beg the question that, you know, because people are personally invested in the case, like I mentioned before, they're definitely more inclined to just appeal. Whereas the Crown, if they don't think it's a winning case or that the appeal will be successful, they're much less likely to follow through with it. Yes, just move on. Exactly right.
But I think the whole aspect here, Alan, and I'm sure you'd agree, is we accept that the courts are made up of humans and humans were fallible. There's mistakes that are made. So something might have been admitted into evidence that shouldn't have been admitted into evidence, or something may have been, there may have been a point of law. So quite often there's points of law. So, or sometimes there is, and it's just not reasonable for a jury to come to a verdict or come to a certain, or that's the appeal point. And so there could be all sorts of grounds for appeals. So, yeah, look, I think you're right. If you're in jail, you've got nothing to lose.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean...
all right. The other thing is too, so, all right, Joe Bloggs, we'll say he got 6 years for something, I don't know. So minimum six and, you know, 12 or something, and, you know, with a minimum six, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. So he logs up and he says, well, I reckon I've been dutted here. Or I reckon, I'm not guilty, or B, the sentence is much too hard. Well, no, forget about the sentence being too hard. So he says, well, I reckon I was innocent here. So he lodges an appeal. What does the judge have to take into account before he decides whether there'll be a retrial or not?
So the appeal process is actually quite simple. The judge will just consider whether there was an error that resulted in an unfair or unnecessarily harsh punishment. What is mentioned is that you can't appeal if you simply don't like the outcome. It needs to have some form of proper basis. So they're not going to allow a trial and then allow another trial again based on the same thing because you don't like the outcome. So the judge has to be satisfied that an error existed in the original sentencing and that a different sentence should be imposed. Right. So, yeah, in other words, there must be a significant difference that the judge believes the appeal will result to. So, for example, if we're talking, you know, a person got given 10 years and the judge thinks that's too harsh, it would have to be a fairly significant difference.
All right, so that's just to do with the sentence.
Yeah.
But what's the judge got to do if I come along and say, well, I'm innocent.
Yeah.
And I got stitched up for something I didn't do. Yeah. So what does a judge in that case have to consider?
Yeah.
So before he allows the appeal?
Well, the idea that somebody stitched up, you really have to be able to prove. You can't just make an assertion. You've got to be, if somebody has found on the evidence. So often the question is, how did a witness come across during the first trial? And often the judge's determination as to how that person presented as credible or not credible, that's not an appealable point.
Isn't it?
Well, because you can always finesse your evidence the more times you give it a go.
You got
caught out there, so you'll try it a different way. So the assessment as to the character, the truthfulness of a witness is normally not something you can appeal. You can appeal points of law, manifestly unfair, and all sorts of other points, but you can't just... Yeah, you just don't. I didn't give it my best. I had stage fright.
Well, the attorney didn't tell me the right words.
Incompetent counsel. Well, yeah. Counsel's not allowed to tell you what to say. You're not allowed to. It's a breach of the rules to coach a witness. You're allowed to explain the rules.
You say that never happens?
No, but...
You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Now, I know that wasn't Grant's favourite song because he told me so, but we had Dennis Waterman and I Could Be So Good For You. The reason why I played that, of course, Dennis Waterman passed away early this week. I think he was 74. I really enjoyed him in New Tricks and Minder. I thought he was terrific in those. I can't ever remember seeing him in Sweeney, but those other two were terrific. But anyway, it's just disappointing to see Dennis pass away. There'll be no more New Tricks. All right, so we were still talking about the about appeals. We never got to how many times you could appeal.
Well, it depends on where the conviction is recorded. So if you start in the Magistrates Court, then you can obviously appeal to the Supreme Court on a point of law.
Does it go straight to Supreme Court?
Normally on a point of law it would, but you can actually, there are opportunities to uplift. So the Magistrates Court deals with they each deal with things. So the most severe crimes are dealt with by the Supreme Court in the first instance. So those matters, you would go from the Supreme Court to the Court of Appeal in the Supreme Court, and then from there, if you're given leave to do so, and that's not always given, or there may be something in the High Court. There was an interesting case.
Grant, I don't want to cut across you, where does the County Court come in between those?
County Court would hear serious rapes and other. So the seriousness of the crime. So
you don't go from magistrate to the county to the Supreme Court. You go from magistrate straight to the county.
You can under certain circumstances, but normally you'd go sometimes there's an appeal which is called an appeal de novo. So you start again, so you have the whole trial again. Or you can be, and sometimes you can say that there was a judge that misdirected the jury, and so therefore you have to start the whole trial again because there was a misdirection. Mm. So there can be different points. But the interesting one that went to the High Court, and I might have mentioned this before to you, Alan, but there was the chap who was in New South Wales with a gun, and he shot a man across the Murray.
No.
And killed a man on the banks on the Victorian side. And the question was, where should he be tried? Was the crime committed when the bullet entered the man's... Because clearly, if all you were doing was shooting across the river.
Yep.
But, or was it based on his intention at the time, because he was trying to... So that one went all the way to the High Court in terms of the point, an interesting point of jurisdiction, which court should determine this. So I think at the time, Victoria still had harsher penalties than New South Wales. And so... these people wanted the alleged murderer. Anyway, the murderers. The person who shot the gun wanted her to New South Wales because he was in New South Wales, and others were saying, well, it should be in Victoria because that's where you killed the person. So interesting points, always interesting.
Do you know which way that one went?
I believe that in the end it went to New South Wales from memory, but don't quote me on that. But I think, the law is that the water in the Murray to the high water mark on the Victorian side belongs to New South Wales. So if you're standing low on the bank, it's not, you don't have to cross the river or even hop into it. If you're below the high water mark, then you're in New South Wales, even if you think you're in Victoria. So, and that's a constitutional. When Victoria ceded from New South Wales, the New South Welshman didn't give us all the water.
Grant, you want to talk about spying. The people when they're working at home?
Well, this is always the thing. You know, we know that tracking devices are on delivery trucks and security cameras in retail stores, and that's become quite commonplace. But what about when your workers working from home?
Yep.
Can you start to activate a listening device to start to listen to them? Can you turn their camera on and have a look and see that they're doing their work?
Good point.
Obviously, this new technology allows for employers to spy on their employees. Obviously, we think that's not something we do, but particularly as people work from home. So webcam access, random screenshot monitoring. You can even monitor how many times they've touched the keyboard.
Fair
enough. That's been for years and years and years. I remember the first lawyer I knew that got a computer, insisted on getting a computer in the early days. They then assessed how many times she'd touched the keyboard months later, and it wasn't used that much.
All right, so can you do that? Can the employer spy on you?
Well, they shouldn't. So there's laws. So there's a Surveillance Devices Act of 1999 in Victoria, and a person must not knowingly communicate or publish or record or report a private conversation or private activity that has been made as a direct or indirect result of the use of listening devices or optical surveillance devices or tracking devices. So the law's quite clear. I think you'd need to get informed consent.
Because you can track trucks, though, can't you? I mean, they deliver...
Well, I think trucks is fair enough, but people know it up front. I think the thing would be just randomly turning it on. I mean, we've all seen those Zoom calls where people suddenly appears.
Someone pops up out of bed, shouldn't be there.
he should be fully engaged in not other activities. So I just thought that was an interesting one. So there's really an ethical and legal dilemma that people face, and that's coming up in our next newsletter that's coming out.
Sounds good.
G'day, it's Nat from Launching Place, and you're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And if you've got a quick question, give us Griggs out there, 59-615-9159, 615-9191. We can't talk about particular cases, but if you've got some aspect of the law that you'd like to know. Grant, you were just talking about the water, the high line of the water between states.
Yes.
Somebody was asking me the other day, and I wasn't going to bring this up, but I will now see you mentioned it. Where does a freeway stop and start? Now, I'll tell you why. Mm. It's illegal in a car to use your handheld phone, right?
Yep.
So we'll say you're going down East Link or one of those. Yep. You get a phone call. If you pull into the emergency lane, that's an offence anyway, because you're not supposed to be stopping in it. All right, so where does the freeway end? So if you get over that, nearly all freeways have got grass between there and the side of it. Is the grass part of the freeway? Could you be charged if you pull onto the grass, so you're not on any of the tracks, you're not in the emergency lane, you're in the grass on a handheld phone? Now, bear in mind, and I'm not sure, but you'll tell me in a second, when you're actually driving a car, because my understanding is if the keys are in it and the motor's running, you're driving the car. So if I'm sitting over with the motor running on the grass on a handheld phone, am I breaking the law?
Okay, that's a multi-layered question. I love the fact that you present it so simply. And
well, it is to me.
I'll go back from the beginning, from the last point. So when are you? The question is, when are you in control of a vehicle?
Yep.
It's not whether you're driving a vehicle. It's when are you in control? And normally, I believe that is sufficient to have the keys in the ignition, even without the motor running.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So
yeah.
I believe that's the case. So motor running, whether you've got, if the motor running, then clearly there's no question, even if you're stationary. So the issue is control. So then what can you do? I imagine if you pull, what is a freeway, what's a highway, will be by way of there will be a government regulation that says this is the start of the freeway, this is the end of the freeway, and it'll all be in government regulations, and it will be stipulated. Normally the signs should reflect what is actually occurring, but your question is, can I pull off
onto the grass?
I believe you probably committed, like if it's a freeway, I don't believe, except in an emergency, that you would be allowed to do that. So you probably created an offence by leaving a carriageway in that way, because I think, particularly freeways, I think you're meant to stay on except in an emergency, and so there's an exception. So that would be an offence. The fact that you're then on a phone, if you turn the car off, taking the keys out, and you're, and most people won't, I'd ask the question in a different way. And what is so urgent about that? We live in this world that believes that you've got to take every call.
Yep. Mm.
There was a time when you couldn't take calls, and there should always be a time. I find it very liberating to even go out without a telephone. I know it's countercultural. and I've had one client once who was convicted on the basis that the jury didn't believe that he would have gone that long without a mobile phone, which happened to coincide with the time when something happened to his ex-wife. But anyway, leave that to one side. So there is a danger in going out without your phone, because it's considered culturally normal. Yeah. It's considered that if you leave home without your mobile, you're more likely to return than if you leave home without your wallet.
So, true.
That's considered, that's in some of the literature. So I think we need to get away from this idea that you have to take every phone call the moment it's... There is, it's, you know, I think we need to understand that there's a time and a place for all things, and the phone does not determine the priority, you do.
All right, coming back to it though, do you believe that the grass forms part of the
Well, that would be by way freeway. Of government regulation. I think you'd look at it on a normal highway. Can you pull off into a, let's say you pulled off into a farmer's driveway?
Yep.
I think you're fine. But I think the question is, are you creating a danger by way of your behaviour? So then, but are you still on the highway? I'd need to take that one. You know, this would be a great question for Jack to research for me and come back.
Well, Jack, could you send someone along? And that's not the question we've got for you to take away. But all right, so Grant, you want to talk about rental laws?
Well, actually, Jack did, but
I'll... Oh, did he? Oh, you're going to take over?
You want me to do it for you?
No, I'll do it. So we've got
this is for you. All the landlords need to pick up their ear, and all tenants need to pick up, because this is very exciting, isn't it?
Yes. So we've got some new laws concerning landlords and tenants from the 29th of March. Windows in rooms that are likely to be used as bedrooms or living areas.
March this year.
Yes, March this year. Yep. So they must be fitted with curtains or blinds that can be opened and closed, adequately block light, and provide reasonable privacy. So some form of, what's the word, closure between living in your house and the public, I guess, for lack of a better word.
But I suppose that's only fair, though, too, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think you'd reasonably suspect that to be done already. So the fact that we've brought in new laws just makes sure that that's done. Most of the times when I was looking for a house, they just... You just sort of expect that will be done. So It's interesting. And then moving on from that, as of next year, we've got new laws regarding heaters. So they are requiring landlords to make sure that they have installed an energy-efficient fixed heater in a good working order in the main living area of the premises. And if there is an existing fixed heater that is not energy efficient, the landlord must update it.
And what are we saying? How do we know? How does a landlord know what's energy efficient?
I imagine you'd look at the stars, you know, how you look at the stars on the side.
And your energy bill, maybe.
I think this could be part of, you know, greenhouse gas emissions and all sorts of things. Yes, but if you don't do it, the tenants can then require urgent repairs too, and the landlords don't want tenants going off and picking the new heating system. So, yes. But with curtains, I remember when Wendy and I moved into our first house at Chernside Park, it was some dracky orange thing that obviously hadn't been made for the house, reached well below the dragged on the floor, and I think you can get by as long as you've got something to cover it up. So
is there anything else in the new laws?
In the new laws, that's it for now, but...
Watch your space.
What's that, sorry?
Watch your space, is that what you're saying?
Yes, watch your space, so... I think over the COVID pandemic, a lot of emphasis was placed on landlords and tenants. So there was a lot of disputes and issues. So I think that now that there was a public eye on that sort of space, like you're saying, new laws are coming out regulating, making sure that tenants are looked after by their landlords. Because
all right.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
I played that one especially for Grant, because without gangsters, there'd be no work for you guys. That was called Gangster's Paradise.
Yep, and we love those type of songs. keep them coming.
Righto, Grant, windfall tax. You want to tell us a bit about that? This is pretty disturbing, this.
Well, it's a new form of land tax. So in addition to the current land tax, there's a new type of tax on land. It was introduced by the Victorian government.
Yep.
So it's different to capital gains tax. It's different to all sorts of other taxes. It's called the windfall gains tax. And it's a scheme that aims to tax the increase in land value brought about by the government rezoning the land. So if your land, let's say you've got a land that is zoned a particular way and then it's zoned for a housing development, so it goes from worth $100,000 to a couple of $1 million, then the government said, we'd like a bit of that because we've rezoned it. We've done it. We've increased your value we've
rezoned. But you might have owned it for 25 years with your money.
Yep. I'm not arguing the fairness of this tax. I'm just informing people because I do think it doesn't come in until the 1st of July next year, so 2023. So people have time, if they can, to rezone and avoid this because the tax is significant. The government has said that for the first 100,000, if it's going to be less than 500,000, that increases in value, but you can easily see it going over 100,000. They said, look, it's 62.5% that you pay us as tax on the increase caused by the rezoning, but we'll give you the first 100,000 off. If it's over 500,000, forget about any tax-free period or tax-free 100,000. We'll just charge you 50% on all of it. And that runs as a debt from the rezoning or the increase in the value, even if you don't sell it. Because the government will then, it might force you to sell it, actually.
It's not hard to have a property that's worth $1.5 million if it's a few acres. I mean,
sure.
$2 million isn't a lot of money. It is to us, not to you, but it is to me. But
he was pointing at Jack.
but be honest, if you've got 20 or 30 acres, it's not hard for it to be worth $3-4 million, is it?
Now, there are some exceptions, but the basic rule is if it's increased because of rezoning, then you... And I think it's what's manifestly unfair is, let's say, a family has said, we may not put money into super, but we'll go and buy a block of land.
I know a few that have done that.
Knowing that one day it'll go up in value. And you're right. Now, you take out the fact that it's gone up in value as a result of capital gains. So it has to be the government says, on this date it was worth this much, and as a result of the rezoning it's gone up this much. So it's still the government's putting their hand out for a fair bit of money.
Actually, a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
Seems like a lot to not to me.
Well, that's not to you.
And so nobody wants to pay tax unless they... Oh, well, sorry. I think... Look, my father used to be Deputy Commissioner of Taxation, and he said paying taxes, Grant, is your... Not only your lawful, but it's your privilege to contribute to society, but sometimes governments go too far.
Yeah.
And so all right. It's a question of how much.
And welcome back to the Legal Hour on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 7 minutes to one and 18 degrees, chasing 20 degrees. Well, we might even make it. And I must mention again, we've got Jack Kennedy and also Grant Hutchison from Hutchinson Legal. Guys, we always like to send you away with something to do a bit of research on. We actually had, pardon me, we actually had a guy ring me this morning. Now, we're going to put two things together here, but we're talking about AVOs. This is where you've got something against you, isn't it? That anyway, this guy, he admits, now bear in mind, I've got to say two things. We're only hearing one side of the story, and we're not here to judge the story. Mm. And we're not here to judge the police, and we're not here to judge the courts. We just, a guy gets an AVO against him, and he's not happy about it. But he said, look, I pushed the wife around a few times and we had a lot of arguments, so he accepts that. He's had the AVO against him for quite some time. He gets a text from the wife one night saying, I want you to come around. I need to talk to you about one of the children. So he jumps in the car. He thinks, well, I'm not supposed to go, but I got a text here telling me to come, so he goes. And I can tell by looking at Grant's face, he's heard a story like this before. He's knocking on the door. And as he's knocking on the door, the police turn up. So you got to wonder how the police knew he was there. But anyway, let's not judge anything. So they say, well, you know, you've broken the intervention order. We're going to have to charge. And he says, well, I got a text here, and surely if she got the order, she can vary it. And they say, well, no, you can't. So we're not talking about the police here at all. What he wants to know is, obviously in a situation like that, he's never going to go again. But supposing one of the children were really sick and he really got that, can he go to the police and ask them to take him? Do the police have the right to break the order or by taking him there? Or what could happen? So we want to know about that as to what a person could do. The second thing is that this is a case I've been going to talk to you about for the last couple of months, which sort of got put on the back burner, but it happens to be on the same thing. Young blood, well, they're a young couple. I think they're partners. I don't know if their partners will marry. He goes off to work one day. He comes home at night, tries to put the key in the front door, and it won't go in. So he belts it, knocks on the door, and wife, he won't come out, but or partner says, oh, well, I've got an order against you. You can't come in. Go around the back. Your suitcase is in the backyard and that. Now, what he feels that this isn't right. Normally you're presumed innocent until you're proved guilty. So he says, I've got an order against me, which says I've done something wrong. I never got a chance to answer that. There's an order against me. So, I mean, I would like you to have a look at these orders and just see how easy are they to get. Once they've got, how many, like, when does he get to say to put up a defence? And when that happens, are they all still continued, or is it that there must be stats somewhere that says, oh, 95% or 90 or 99% are still held up? And what's the level of proof? Because, well, this guy's saying, well, I never went to court, so how can a court make a decision without me having any input into it?
Good questions, and we'll take those away because I know you don't want the answer now, but we might add one.
Yep.
Because I remember a case where he'd put the property in the wife's name, and
yep,
she changed the locks and sent a taxi around to his work with his stuff in the back. And that was before AVOs were highly popular. And, question is, where's he left? So.
Well, and this guy makes a good point that normally you judge innocent, but he said, as soon as I've got an AVO against me, I'm really looked upon as being guilty of doing something, but I never got a chance to put up any sort of defence. And when does he get to put up a because at this stage it had been in vogue for at least a month when he spoke to me, pardon me, and he still hadn't had any opportunity to put up a defence.
Yeah, quite often, look, I've also heard it when, you know, you ultimately get to chat to somebody and sometimes what the guy calls a tap with a broom handle. Yep. There's a lot more than that. Yep. So I think you've got to be very careful.
Don't disagree. So we really rather...
This is not a Johnny Depp, Amber Heard case. No. With a broken finger, I
guess what we're trying to find out, though, is how easy are they to get? What sort of level of proof do you need to get one? And then when does the other person get to put up their defence?
And they're good questions. We'll come back to you. And so there's different types of AVOs. Some are family, and so we'll just deal with the family side, not the, you know, if you have a disagreement with somebody.
Private argument with you and you tell me to buzz off.
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that to you. You're a good bloke.
Great. We've got a minute and a half. You've got something else you wanted to say.
Always. Watch out. Beware the ATO. Sometimes...
don't you get us in trouble.
No. We love the fact that, as I said, paying your just amount of tax is a privilege and it helps contribute to the roads and everything else that we have.
But as Kerry Packer said once, you don't have to pay a cent more than what you...
You'd be a fool to pay more.
That's it.
Yeah, it was very... but the ATO are just getting a little bit excited. Remember, a lawyer who holds documents for a client... It's covered by legal professional privilege. So the documents belong to the client and it's their information. Sometimes the ATO are coming to the lawyers and we'd like those documents. And so that's always... And they're saying, oh, your legal professional privilege shouldn't apply. Give them to us. Now, I had a... We might come back to this next time because I don't want to go over time, but had a good person I knew in the legal profession. His name was Chris. And so when they came knocking for documents... He said, I claim privilege for these documents. You claim they're not. I'm not going to let you look at them, but we'll stick them in the envelope, put them to one side, and we'll have a fight in court and let the judge decide whether it's caught by legal professional privilege. But the ATO are threatening lawyers with, hey, look, Anyway, next week. Or no, next month.
Next month. Grant and Jack, it's really fantastic to have you in again. We always enjoy this hour. It's always a bit of fun, and we learn a little bit about what the law each time. So... Thank you for your time again, and we'll look forward to seeing somebody next month from Hutchison Legal.
Always. Thanks.
Sounds good. Pleasure.